good snowy evening, everybody. This is Rick Kogan. The show is After Hours. That is the music of Bob Mamet, an extraordinary piano player who will be in here after my first guest, Ron Balson. Ron, welcome to the show. And boy, we were smart about this weather, weren't we?
You're not kidding.
Wow. Ron, we're literally emailing all day saying, well, it doesn't look that bad. Weathermen are really stupid. They don't know what they're talking about. Let's wait and see. Ron has been one of my favorite guests for a couple of years now, and also one of my favorite people, and also one of my favorite writers. He is a novelist of immense, immense talent and sensitivity, whose latest is sitting right in front of me, The Girl from Berlin. It is the fifth novel that Ron has written since deciding, well, I'm a lawyer. I've been a lawyer for 40 years, and I want to write a novel. Ron, before we get to The Girl from Berlin, which I just found absolutely thrilling, I'd be remiss not to allow you to inspire would-be writers out there by telling your tale. You're litigating a case in Poland a few years back, and you had never been there. You have no familial connection to the Holocaust. But you started to notice something in Warsaw, did you not?
Well, not just Warsaw.
Yeah.
I mean, this case that I had took me all around Poland. Took me to Krakow and took me to Samoszyn and to Bitsa. And the case really concerned telephone service in the southern mountains, so it took me down there, too. But I, you know... If you are somebody who is interested in history, and I've always been interested in history, and if you are certainly if you're Jewish, if you have a heart,
yeah, that's
and you
more
walk around,
yeah.
If you walk around Poland and you you know you're walking on a battlefield, you're walking on a country that ceased to be, that was totally annihilated and carved up during the war, and then you walk around, you see memorials everywhere, monuments everywhere, and you realize what devastation has taken place there. And so that's I said to myself, if I'm ever going to write a novel, this is something I can do.
You felt it, though, Ron Balson, on a very visceral level, I think, and it inspired you to. You are a trained historian. You majored in English and history at, if memory serves, at Tulane.
That's right.
Your mother wanted you to do something else, but you decided
That's
to come
right.
back. You
my decided, mother wanted me to be a doctor.
Don't. Well, you're a good Jewish son. Come on, it's my that famous routine of Nichols and May. My son, the nurse. But you were so inspired. History has always been a passion of yours. So delving into it in preparation for your first novel, Once We Were Brothers, must have been fascinating for you.
Well, it's true, but I've been a lawyer for 46 years, I think the skills that you develop when you practice law, especially litigation, when you're writing briefs, you're doing a lot of research. You know, you have to be persuasive and
sure.
compelling in your arguments, and you're really nothing but a storyteller.
Well, so, you told the story. You told the story in a certain number of pages, and you sort of, for as good a lawyer as you are, you're a little bit naive about the world of big-time publishing. You tried to get an agent, and you got notes back from these people like, along the lines of, I liked your book, but I really didn't love it. And then one that must have actually hurt you, you got a note that said, you shouldn't be a writer. Why did that not just clip this novelist career in the bud?
It almost did. I mean,
yeah.
I sent out dozens of sample chapters and summaries and whatnot to agents and in hopes of getting an agent to take on my work and present it to a publishing company. But I got nothing but rejections back. And finally, an agent agreed to take it up, but couldn't sell it. And so, I did get so many rejections, and you do start questioning your own worth. You start thinking, why? Jesus, if all these people think I'm I'm a bad writer, and this is a bad idea for a book. Maybe it really is.
Well, but you also thought, and I have found this charming, that that's one way that would force you away from it. But on the other side, you think to yourself, wait a minute, do all these people send out the same kind of form letter to everybody? You know, and maybe these are kind of form letters. That book, you publish it yourself with the help of your son. You wrote it with the help of the encouragement of your wonderful first reader, beautiful wife, Monica. You put it online. It sold maybe 100 copies in 7 months. Then it sold 1,000. Then it sold 5,000. Then an editor at St. Martin's Press picked it up. That must have been such a fulfilling thing for you. She signed you to a 3-book deal, yes?
Yes, and it was thrilling. You know, when you get rejected, I mean, you put your heart into something, takes you 3.5 years to write it.
Yeah.
And when you get rejected, most times, you get rejected by a postcard, the most impersonal way of rejecting something. And I came to believe that maybe there is a stationery store somewhere.
Somewhere in Manhattan,
That stocks pre-printed rejection postcards. And if you're an agent, you can call up and replenish your supply.
And send them all to the suburbs of Chicago. Yeah. I'm talking for at least the next half hour with Ron Balsam, one of my favorite people, one of the most talented writers this area has ever seen. They have seen him only recently. Do you ever? I know you're now becoming incredibly prolific, but do you ever think to yourself? Do you wake up in the middle of the night? You've had a wonderful and successful career as a lawyer. Do you ever wonder? Wow, I wonder what it would have been like if I'd started writing novels right out of college. Does that thought ever occur to you?
No.
Good.
I think so.
Good. Good. We got a little commercial.
I'm not a guy who looks backwards, I don't think. I don't think that occurs to me.
Well,
I
mean, you were
might have been nice, but I would have gotten.
Now you'd be spoiled. Nah. I wouldn't like you, and Bonnie Kolak wouldn't autograph albums for you, and you'd be spoiled.
I'm still looking for that album.
I know. I'm gonna bring it over to you. I went over to your office one day, and they go, "He's not here." And I thought, wait, maybe he's in a secret room writing a novel. We got to take a little commercial break, and we'll be back with Ron Balsam. We will eventually get to his latest book, The Girl from Berlin, but believe me, I will convince you in the interim to buy all of his books. This week on Chicago's Best, the CB team is exploring the Italian boot, one dish at a time, at Chicago's Best Italian, Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV. That's interesting because Ron's new book, it may be titled The Girl from Berlin, is set mostly in Italy. We'll be right back. That is the sound of one of Chicago's great musicians, Bob Mamet, who will be in later today. I'm talking to Ron Balsam about his amazing career, but also his grand talent. You once said to me, Ron, we were talking now about your fifth novel, The Girl from Berlin, and like you cannot write. You once told me, let me see if I can find this, that it is impossible for you to write Holocaust-focused books back-to-back because your characters are real to me, real people, and I am living with them when I write, living with the horrors of the Holocaust. One of the things that distinguishes The Girl from Berlin is it certainly introduced, I'm no historian, you know that, but it introduced me to the nature of those perilous times in Italy. A little of the book takes place in Berlin as you go back from contemporary times into the 30s and 40s. Was that a conscious desire? What inspired this tale?
Well, I'll tell you, you'll enjoy this.
I know I will. I enjoy everything you tell me.
I know. My son, a few years ago, went over to Florence for a junior year study abroad, and I put "study" in air quotes. And he's well, that's a boondoggle they run.
Oh, I know it. Never participated, but I know it.
Yeah. So at the end of the summer, I went over there, and he and I were roaming around Italy in a father-son kind of thing. And as we were going through Tuscany and trying to hit as many wineries as we could.
Sure.
You know, you go into those wineries and they take you down to the cellar. They tell you about their wines. And you think to yourself, wow, this winery has probably been in this Italian family
hundreds
for 400 years.
Yeah.
But sometimes they say, you know, this winery is owned by a German corporation.
Huh.
And so I started thinking, wow, you know, after the war, we know that Germany seized and confiscated a lot of properties during the war. But after the war, they were supposed to return them all. And it didn't always happen. And,
sure.
And, yeah, and the people couldn't always be found to return it to. And so that got me to thinking and researching properties in Italy and what happened to Italy during the war. There isn't a lot. I don't think there's a lot of fiction written about Italy.
There is very, very little. I did, on my own, not being the historian you are, a little bit of research trying to discover novels. And it's a thin pile. It's a very thin pile. So for you, it's wonderful, you know, ripe territory for you to imagine and explore. You, of course, talking about familiar characters, you have created a couple that is one of my favorite teams of all fiction, and that is saying quite a bit. Liam Taggart is a private detective, and Catherine Lockhart is a lawyer. They are present in almost all of your novels. How's your relationship now with those two? You know what I mean? I know that you're
best friends, you know?
Yeah. And they obviously in this book they are not one-dimensional people at all. They are interesting and in some minor ways kind of flawed, I think. You must be very pleased to have them as best friends, that you can stick into any book you're writing and know that they'll come through for you.
I really do think I know these characters.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, this is the fifth novel that they've been in, and under all sorts of different circumstances, because they were in Northern Ireland and
that was in the trust.
Israel, and yeah. So,
that was saving Sophie.
But they're comfortable for me to write because I think I know them so well. I think I know these characters' thoughts and how they would respond to things. So it's a comfortable thing for me to write them.
Yeah. Do you feel, Ron, as a, and I should mention your website, it's Ronald Balson, BALSON.com, where you can buy all of his books. But that'd be a nice thing for you to give someone a gift of 5 Ron Balson novels for Hanukkah or Christmas or Kwanzaa or whatever it is you celebrate, because they're all fantastic. One of the great, I just have to mention, maybe it's one of the favorite openings of a novel I have ever read. Once We Were Brothers, it begins at the Civic Opera House when a man who used to be a starter at the Waveland Golf Course, two old men have a confrontation. It is one of the great scenes. One is arrested. He gets help from Liam and blah, blah, blah. I will not detail the rest of it for you. Is it easier to write now? That book took you 3 years while being a practicing attorney. Is the craft and art of writing easier for you now?
Yeah, some days it is. Some days it's tough, but I think you do improve, as with anything else that you do over and over again.
Yeah.
I think, you know, things become easier. You know, then you can understand how one scene morphs into another. It's easier to do the research, I think, because you know where to look.
Sure.
So I think it is a little easier.
I know you
and
do.
So, I
know you do, Ron Balson, a lot of speaking at various organizations around the country. Do you feel part of the Chicago literary community?
You bet.
Do you?
In every one of my books, there's some Chicago.
Oh, no question.
And I got to tell you, because the book I'm working on now, and it's really just fragments, just pieces I'm trying to pull together. It's also a Second World War II story, but it also takes place in Albany Park in 1965.
Wow.
And it's really deep into what's going on in Albany Park, because for me, that's just the story of Albany Park's a fascinating story.
No question. No question. What area? You were born in Chicago, but raised in the suburbs, right?
That's right. Yeah. I was born in Rogers Park till about fourth grade.
And then you got out of there.
Suburbs, yeah.
But you still do have, I mean, you work downtown and you have a great, great affection for this city. Now, your wife, Monica, with whom you have had eight children, is she still your first reader?
Absolutely.
And how do you...
Reads every page when they come out of the typewriter.
Is that right? Wow.
Yes.
Wow. And she's still...
She's critical. She's critical.
Who loves your writing more, do you think, me or Monica? It's a toss-up.
Tonight, so I don't know. It might be you.
It's kind of a toss-up. And your publisher, you're still with St. Martin's Press. I see that.
Yeah.
Are they expecting... Do you have a deal for another book?
Informally.
Sure.
Informally.
Sure. What about Ron Balson movie nibbles? Because your books are on a million different levels cinematic. You must have had some dealings with the idiots in Hollywood.
No. The characterization's correct.
No kidding.
Once We Are Brothers actually has been sold to a production company.
Wow.
So, yeah, they bought it lock, stock, and barrel. And they have a director, and they have a script. I don't know, it's poking along at the speed of Hollywood.
It is really. Well, the nice thing is that you sold it. Crazy thing would be to start telling people, oh, it'll be out next year, because so many movies run into so many problems. It's a crazy scene. Do you try to write every day?
Yes, I try to write every day.
Yeah.
Sometimes things get in the way. And
you're still practicing law, right?
Yeah, I'm still practicing, and I've had a busy few weeks. And so I hadn't written that much the last few weeks.
And here come the holidays, and here come the snowstorms, and here come everything else.
It's snowing pretty good out at my house.
I'll bet it is. Yeah, it's just miserable down here. I think we made the right choice. Ron, if you can stick around through the news, I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking specifically about the girl from Berlin, and you can, without giving away too much, give the listeners some plot twists. It's an old, it starts with Catherine Lehmer at an Italian restaurant, and Catherine gets hit on to help somebody. Can you stay on for just a few more minutes? You're in your own cozy home, right?
My pleasure.
You don't have to go anywhere, right? Thank God.
We'll
be back. Yeah, we'll be back with Ron Balson to talk specifically about his latest book, The Girl from Berlin. That's Bob Mamet. He'll be in here in about 10 minutes. I'm lucky to have a few more minutes left with Ron Balson to talk about his latest novel, the latest of five, The Girl from Berlin, which is you have a great facility, Ron, as good as any author I've read of slipping back and forth in time. Much of the book is sent in kind of contemporary Italy, and it also brilliantly moves back to pre-war and Germany and pre-war Italy, and then wartime, World War II, that is, Italy. That's one of your great strengths. And I do you plot these books before you write them?
People ask me, do I write from an outline? And then I think I write more from a timeline.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I know where I want to go, and I know what events I want to cover, and of course, I know how the book is going to end. And so I really write more from a timeline. But then as you go along, whatever the creative process,
sure,
it's steers you in one direction or another.
Things change. And one of the things, this is in large part, the book is the unraveling of a mystery in the face of horrors and corporate corporate shenanigans, I'll put it mildly. Who is, Ron Boston, if I might ask, Sarah Teitelbaum, to whom you, of course, dedicate the book to your wife, Monica, your first reader. You also dedicate it to Sarah Teitelbaum. You write, a gifted concert pianist and teacher who soloed with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra and from whom I inherited my love of opera.
She is my maternal grandmother.
Oh.
Well, was my eternal grandmother.
How sweet.
She's deceased now.
But, how sweet.
Oh, but she did. You know, she had opera on constantly when I would visit her. She played classical music all the time, and she was a piano teacher, and she really gave me a love of music. And so that's the Girl from Berlin has a lot of music in it.
Well, and well grounded, and yes, because the. Well, there's a woman. I don't want to give away. You know, it's hard sometimes, right? It's hard to talk about your books before people have read them. I mean, there's a kind of a secret, not a secret manuscript, and you know, in the manuscript are other secrets are unraveled in that. And of course, you have Liam and Catherine on the trail of this thing. Those are two of the most compelling characters of modern fiction. Ron Boston, to you and Monica. First, I got to ask you, because I'm going to drop off. The last time you were in studio, and I think you were very wise to stay home tonight, when you hear Roger Bettis say up to 13 inches, you go, well, that'd be fun getting home now. You brought in an album because you thought, and she was on the radio, but she was on by phone, a Bonnie Kolak. Can you talk to me for 2 minutes about your affection for Bonnie? Because I got her in person to autograph that album for you, and I'm going to drop it off at your office for your Christmas present.
Awesome. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, you were.
I can remember the days when she was at the Earl, and yeah. She and Steve Goodman, I always think of and for one, just for this reason, I'm kind of sorry that I'm not down there with you tonight, because I always think of your studio as a repository for Chicago culture.
Oh, isn't that's very sweet.
Well, it's the Mike Royko and the Studs Terkel and all the
now you're too Chicago complimentary.
Well, we need to keep it alive.
I know.
And so, Bonnie Kolak's a part of that series.
She is indeed. Let's plan. If your next book, keep writing that next one. Try to get it out in the fall or when it's not snowing out, and then you can come in, and I promise you I'll book Bonnie on the same show.
That's a deal.
Ron, I will deliver this album to you. Thank you so much for the book. You are really just continue to be a literary giant of Chicago. That's what you are. It's not kind. I'm a critic. I'm accurate. Ron, best to you and your wife over the holidays, and to all of your kids, too.
Same to you, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to talk to Bob Mamet for, 45 minutes and hear some of his music. Now, who is that? Who's playing there? Who's playing? Can you always tell Bob Mamet and welcome to the show? And it's great to see you again and great to see your brother Tony. And please give your mom my love. Can you tell your own playing? I've never even thought that. You can immediately tell.
Well, thank you, Rick.
That's you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're welcome here anytime. That's from, that's from Impromptu.
Yes, that's from my Impromptu album.
You did with the trio.
That's right.
You've got a gig coming up at Jazz Showcase.
That's right.
When?
It's Wednesday, December 5th.
Oh, great.
Yes.
Good.
Yes, 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. Shows at 8 p.m. and 10 p.m.
You can go to bobmamet.com. BOBMAMET. You love playing the showcase, don't you?
It's a great venue. I think it's one of the best venues in the country, really. It's just a great jazz venue to I love going there as a spectator and always love to play there.
Yeah, and you seem, I must tell you, you seem incredibly comfortable on that stage, too.
Well, thank you.
You really do. Even with your mom sitting in the front row, the devoted jazz fan.
That's right.
You spent, Bob, a lot of time in L.A.
Yes.
You're born and raised and grew up in Chicago.
I did, yeah.
This is where you got the music bug. But then
That's
you
right.
went out there for a time. Tell me again, remind the listeners, I'm sure some of them are fans, what that scene was like.
Well, you know, I was there. I first moved out there in the early 80s, and it was a big, you know, the scene I was in was like studio musician, film composer, you know, that kind of thing in Hollywood. And it was very vibrant, you know, back then. It was a lot of the studio music and the music you heard on TV and things like that were very jazzy. You know, it was very jazzy stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the crime shows. And
sure.
Kojak. And, you know, stuff like that. You know, it's like very...
urban, yeah.
Yeah, urban jazz. And so it was fun. It was a fun scene to be in. And then it kind
were
of...
there a lot of...
Yeah.
I've never been able to get a handle on the jazz scene in L.A. Club-wise.
Yes.
Is there one?
There's definitely a jazz. It's changed over the years. It's kind of shifted, you know, since I've moved back here to Chicago, but I still get back to L.A. a lot. It's kind of shifted to a more kind of modern rock and, you know, clubby, you know, type of thing.
Yeah.
Electronica, things like that. When I first was there in the earlier days, it was a lot of jazz, tons of jazz clubs, you know. But then over the years, it kind of shifted. I think, to be honest with you, I think there's a much more vibrant jazz scene here in Chicago.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah.
I just think of L.A. as a place that is more knee-jerk reaction to trends. And,
yes.
And here. So what drew you back to Chicago?
Well, a lot of things. I mean, first of all, being from here,
there's a pull. It's like your half brother David,
yes.
Mammoth, the famous playwright. When I was out there talking to him about his novel,
yes,
his big deal novel, Chicago,
yes,
he and I got in a very long conversation about this pull.
That's right.
That the city will.
I think. Anyone who's grown up here, you know, wherever they move, if they move to New York, you know, L.A., anywhere, there is a pull to come back. There's the people, you know, the people that you relate to,
yeah.
you know, are
yeah.
still here. Even new people you meet are still, they're Chicagoans, you
yeah.
know.
And yeah. there's something, and I, not to get overly romantic about
yes.
it, but there is a kind of, there's a, you know, a sort of, honesty here that I can't imagine exists in Los Angeles.
I mean, yeah, there definitely is an honesty here. There's an authenticity here in Chicago.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the word.
For
That's
sure.
the word.
For sure.
During this segment, I promised we'd play some tunes, too. You want to hear something now?
Go
ahead.
Number nine. How about number nine?
Number nine from the White Album.
Yes, That's a tune called Kitsia. Yes.
Kitsia.
Yeah.
How? Pop Mammoth, that's really beautiful. Tell me about that tune.
Well, you know, that, I
when did this album come out?
This came out a few years back.
Yeah.
And it was actually my first trio record.
Was it recorded here?
It was actually recorded in L.A.
Okay.
You know, but I played a lot of the tunes from here. And that tune, Katsia, I loosely call an Israeli samba, because it mixes the modalities of the Middle East and Hebrew music with the rhythms of Brazil.
Yeah.
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 So.
Now, you came back, and you are performing on December 5th at Jazz Showcase.
Yes.
You haven't gigged around much
lately.
You have a regular thing, right? Do you want to talk about that? Semi-regular thing up in the sky.
Oh, up at the John Hancock Building,
we still call it that. What is it now? I don't even know what it's called now.
875 North Michigan.
That's ridiculous.
We know it's John Hancock Building.
Where do you play? 875 North Michigan. Oh, really? Well, what's that building?
And I do play up there the first Saturdays of every month. Every first
By yourself.
Saturday. Yeah, doing a solo piano sets.
Bar.
At the restaurant.
Interesting. The 95th, the famous
95th. The 95th, the first Saturdays of every month, Saturday nights. And I do my versions of the hit songs dating back from the 1930s until today.
I haven't been up there in ages. Yeah.
It's nice.
Do you like it?
Yeah. No, it's very nice. It's very nice. But I mean, I still do tour, but not as much. I'm actually going to be playing in L.A. After this Jazz Showcase show.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going headed to L.A. to play. But I like hanging around more now. You know, hanging around. You know, I mean, notwithstanding the weather, of course.
Yeah, of course. But, do you go out and hear a lot of other musicians?
I do. I do try to. I do, and I know you have some good musicians coming up, right?
Yeah, they'll be on the phone. Because they had a gig in Oak Park. And Petra Van Noyes and I too were like emailing all day saying weathermen are stupid, they don't know anything, let's wait and see, it could be sunny.
Well, she's got a tough job nowadays.
She's a grand talent.
I'm looking forward to hearing her.
One of the things is, too, Bob, in this town is there are so many talented and friendly musician. I mean, I know there's some jerks out there, but generally this is a very nurturing climb.
Very much. Very much. Musicians here in Chicago, they support each other and they, look out for each other. This is good.
That's another part of that, the authenticity I think we were talking about. I mean, there's no real ladder to be climbed here. I mean, if you're playing the showcase every once in a while, that's about as good as it gets anywhere, right?
Well, I think, first of all, the venue itself has moved around, you know, geographically in Chicago many times, but it's maintained its integrity. It's just like one of the best jazz clubs you can play at.
When Joe Siegel, the legendary Joe Siegel,
and now his son Wayne runs it now too.
Joe came into the studio before we left. Like, I said, "Really, Joe? You're 90 something."
That's right. I think he's 92 or something like that.
92, and he's been doing it. He says, "I'm not as old as Studs was." And he decided to come into the studio.
That's great.
The last time I saw you play, I think was at Pianoforte. Which is a great venue on South Wabash.
That is a great venue.
Or South Michigan.
South Michigan. Thomas Zoles runs that place, and it's a really great. I mean, they do mostly classical there, but they do represent the jazz community there too, and I do play there a lot as well.
Yeah.
And it's just a really great venue if anyone is looking for a more intimate but still a really vibrant classical and jazz venue. That's a great one.
Ladies and gentlemen, go to bobmammoth.com to learn more about Bob Mammoth, or stay tuned to learn more about Bob Mammoth, because we'll talk more about his career right after the news, and you'll hear another tune of his choosing. And his brother Tony will be on here in the spring to talk about movies and music and all sorts of other things. He's over here. He was visiting for Thanksgiving, and he's not flying anywhere.
Not tonight.
I love that song. But remember, that the news was brought to you by victoryautorecords.com, if I forgot to tell you all that. What about Bob Mamet will be with his trio?
Yeah, the trio, some special guests as well.
And special guests?
Yes,
okay,
yes,
good.
Yes.
December 5th, that's Wednesday, at 8 and 10 at Jazz Showcase.
That's right.
Almost without argument, the best club between New York and, I don't think, Hawaii. I don't think LA has any clubs. Between New York and China.
That's right.
The best jazz club between New York and China. Anything different about this show, Bob?
Well, one thing.
Special guests.
Yes. You know. But, you know, we're going to do, in addition to original tunes, I'm going to be doing a few different original tunes, that I haven't maybe done in a while. But also, we're going to do a tribute to the great jazz pianist McCoy Tyner. He's turning 80 years old in a couple weeks, really.
Wow.
I think it's December 13th he's turning 80 years old. But so here, we're playing on the 5th. And so very close to his 80th birthday, we're going to do a little bit of a tribute on a few of the tunes just to give a little, a lot of the fans, are people are big fans of McCoy Tyner, and then some people don't even know who he is.
Right. One of the things in your career in music, what has changed markedly is the recording end of jazz music. You have a number of CDs.
That's right.
But now, who buys CDs? I don't even know if people buy CDs anymore.
No, a lot of them are streaming. Yes.
More
of my music is just streamed.
Well, but it changes the whole. We once talked at length about how one conceives, and I've talked a lot about this with jazz folk.
Yes.
How you conceive of a CD. There's a narrative to it. One song follows another, not indiscriminately, but for a reason.
That's right, and you can see with the packaging, you could see all the players and who played on it. That was that used to be a big thing, like who played bass and who played. Now, people are just they enjoy just listening to the music, is streaming it, and it's a little bit more disposable because you don't physically hold it in your hands. If you want it, you stream it.
It bothers me. I'm going to tell you. No, I am going to tell you. Right. It troubles me.
Uh-huh.
And that's because I'm some kind of Luddite about it. It troubles me because you're right. There is packaging involved, and there are songs one following the other for a specific reason.
That's right. Programming.
How has it changed your notion of recording?
Well, I mean, one of the things is just what you said. You're not thinking as much from tune to tune to tune. Every tune has to be, should be, a through composed, a standalone song, as opposed to, like maybe in the past, you would have a little prelude on one tune and then another tune, which is the main tune, and another tune as an afterthought. You can't really do that anymore because someone's just going to listen to your afterthought and say, what's this?
Yeah.
When they put it out, when they stream it or when it comes on, Sirius radio, Sirius XM radio, which I like. I mean, they play me on Sirius XM radio. Spotify, all that stuff. I like it. I think it introduces your music to.
Interesting. It broadens the audience.
Broadens the audience, but I definitely agree with you as well that it does dilute a little some of the finer points of jazz that were traditions for many years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you sit down to write, how often do you do that?
I try to do it. When the mood strikes me, if I'm thinking something in my head, I'll sit down, or sometimes I'll improvise for an hour, and then maybe you'll get 90 seconds of something that might be a little kernel of composition that you'll go with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You are my favorite jazz musician. You know that.
Well, thank you, Ray. Thank you.
Come see Bob Mamet at the one and only Jazz Showcase, December 5th at 8 and 10. With two shows with special guests. You will not divulge who those special guests might be. And I can't even guess. How could I even guess? Love to your mom. She'll be there.
Yes.
She'll be there.
Yes.
So Kathy Murray, who at one point said, well, I don't really like jazz, but that Bob Mamet, whatever he's doing, is the greatest. Now she's a big jazz fan, which is a great thing to turn her on to that music. Because I think a lot of people, too, in a couple of minutes we have left, a lot of people will say, you know, I don't like jazz. And you probe them a little bit, and you realize, well, you know, they were introduced to jazz through Miles Davis rather than Ella Fitzgerald. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, sure.
And so, to my mind, it's if you think you hate jazz, invest 5 minutes and hear something you've never heard before.
That's a great...
Because it can thereby enrich the rest of your life.
Absolutely, absolutely. Check,
and, And Bob Mamet on December 5th at 8 and 10 would be the way to do that. It's always great to see you, it's Bob. Love to the family.
Thank
love
you
to
so
the
much.
Family. Get home safely, though.
Yes, you
that's
as well.
My main. You know, I could always sleep on a couch here because it's only like two blocks away from the Tribune. I'm living a nightmare here. All my jobs and my place are living here in a small, small little sphere. We'll take a little break and come back, and you'll hear from Petra Van Noyes, and she has a new CD out. Dennis Luxian, who I've never met, but I do know Petra. They're out in Oak Park, and we'll talk to them and hear some music. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the piano of Bob Mamet, who, when he was in here, told me he is a huge fan of my next guest, Petra Van Noyes. Petra, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Petra and I, too, have been emailing back and forth all day saying we hate weathermen. They're stupid. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. Let's wait. Maybe it'll be sunny at 9 o'clock at night. How was your gig? Where did you play today?
I was playing with Dennis Luxian, the pianist who we will hear tonight, I'm sure, on your show with the CD that I sent you. I was playing with Dennis at a restaurant that we play at on Sundays called Mancini's. It's a nice family-style Italian restaurant in Oak Park.
You have been...
So would you believe I just got home, right walked in the door and you called. So
how's the traveling? Bad?
It would be better if one of my windshield wipers wasn't broken.
It'd be better if it wasn't raining, sleeting, and snowing.
Exactly.
Well, when you go home to your longtime companion, Andy Brown. I wrote about you guys, it must have been 5 years ago. I was so taken with you that you and Andy kind of fell in love at first sight in high school, and then made your way in the musical world. How is it, Petra, that you got hooked up? I feel bad because I've only heard Dennis Luxian on this new CD because we're night people. He's a great piano player, I gotta tell you. And I'm so sorry. I don't think I've ever seen him. How did you two connect?
Well, when I moved here, I just heard legends about him. He's kind of... Well, he's such a humble man. That's probably why you haven't heard about him.
Yeah, not very, the classic self-promoter, right?
Yes, very unassuming. He's mostly a sideman, I think because of that reason, although he's an excellent leader when he needs to be, and he writes amazing tunes as well. He's a great composer. But he and I met just on a gig. And I was really excited because I had heard about him, and somebody asked me to sub, and he was the pianist, and I was just excited because I knew he was amazing. He has played with everybody. He lived in Europe for a while and actually played with Chet Baker for
I know
many
there's a, on his website,
years.
There's a sort of almost haunting picture of Dennis with Chet Baker. How do you think, and ask him, if to make up an answer for him, I'm very curious how, and he may have talked about it with you, how that experience, he's a kid from, born and raised in Springfield, went to the U of I, mm-hmm. and then spent a considerable amount of time playing internationally. How do you think that affects his playing? Obviously for the best, but in what kind of ways, Petra?
Well, I think, I don't know what he would say. I am speaking for him. Well, probably just playing with any legendary people really affects your playing. And I think he was pretty young when he did that stint. So he not only played with Chet, but he recorded with him. He was on a lot of television programs. And I mean, I think that's just exposure to the real deal, you know? So, yeah. I mean, nothing, there's no better education than that, probably. But the European thing, I don't know. Andy and I just went to Europe 2 weeks ago, and we had some observations about the audiences. Like, they're very respectful, more so than here. I mean, some of it is almost like they respond like it's a classical concert almost.
Yeah, interesting.
Like, they're very quiet. Yeah, no one pulls out a smartphone. Everyone is dead quiet. So I'm assuming that, especially when Dennis was there, which was, you know, years ago,
must have been even more so.
Church-like. Yeah, church-like.
What did you and Andy think of that? Was it jarring for you, or did you think, wow, I wish all crowds were like this? There's got to be a middle ground, I think, don't you?
I do agree. I think it was both. I mean, there are elements of that that are really beautiful, but then in another way, I think, you know, we're American at heart, so we kind of like a little bit of grittiness and people talking and a little bit of, you know, just that whole American loud vibe. We're just used to it.
Well, like, you know, talk to Judy Roberts about playing in the lobby of the Intercontinental Hotel. She'll give you an earful when she used to do that years ago. Now, how did this, playing with Dennis Lukshin is one thing. And, you know, obviously musicians share their feelings and their emotions and their likes and their dislikes. How does that first meeting grow into this, what I think is a remarkable CD, Because We're Night People? How does it grow? The seed is meeting, and then it progresses, obviously, from there, yes?
I agree with you. I mean, I feel like everyone that I've really had a connection with, both musically and personally, and you probably know this from just life, is that when you usually kind of have an immediate connection with someone, kind of a blink reaction to them, that you just dig them from the start. And I just, of course, respected Dennis from the start. And also, just the thing that struck me about his playing was just his sensitivity. And I feel like, for me, I'm not really a big singer, a loud singer. Mm-hmm. I'm not a showy singer. And right. I feel like Dennis and I complement each other, because he also has those qualities of kind of more of like a tenderness and like a quiet, mellow, you know, kind of vibe. So right away, I just felt like we were birds of a feather. And luckily, though, at first we didn't play together so much, but then in the past maybe 4-5 years, I feel like we've been playing together quite a lot, like at least once a week, which is nice.
And then I'm talking to Petra Van Noyes, whose website is Petra, P-E-T-R-A, sings.com. And she and Dennis Lukshin just have their new, and they play, you guys are really both, you more so than, and your husband Andy Brown, more so than even Dennis, you guys really work. I mean, you are all over the place, aren't you, Petra?
Well, given the pay scale, I mean, I hate to be grim, but you kind of have to work. But also, as musicians, we all like to work. I don't know. We just don't know how to say no, number one. And number two, I mean, well, also, Dennis, I mean, he works as much as or more than us. I mean, all of us are kind of the same. We're all a little bit crazy. And I know you know Eric Schneider.
Yeah,
the
very
wonderful
well.
Reed man, but he always says something funny to me, because I think of him as the person that works the most. He's always going from one thing to another, and he's always running out of a gig to go somewhere else. And he always says, helps to be crazy.
Well, you could throw Phil Grateau into that gang too, I think.
The great
drummer. There are a number of people you could throw into that whole thing. So tell me, I'm very curious. So you play with him and meet him about 5 years ago and you're talking. When does the conversation turn to, because making a CD these days is, I think, in the strange way of modern day recording, a big creative leap. Who broaches that idea? Did you say, you know, we should make a CD together?
Well, this was a very fortunate situation for me because Dennis actually broached the idea, and that to me was a real honor. Even if the CD had never been made, just the fact that he asked me to make it was a very big compliment. I felt excited because, honestly, I heard you speaking before, right before I came on the air, about CDs and
streaming.
As you said, yeah, it's not really the wisest choice at this point. You don't even, in some ways, know exactly why you're doing it, but you just do it nonetheless.
Sure.
But I feel like it's a good thing to do, even if you don't know exactly why you're doing it, because you do kind of document a process, and it does force you to focus in on something. And when Dennis asked me, I'd already been making a couple of CDs, so I was kind of, after the last CD I did, actually one with Andy Brown, my husband, on guitar, I was like, that's the last CD for a long time. And then Dennis mentioned this. Said earlier, you, as musicians, we only say yes.
Because you're all crazy. I also think, and I was railing about it, but the fact that in creating a CD at a time, you are capturing, I think, that time. You're capturing the performer's sensibilities about the various tunes that they select and the order in which they select them. You are catching your voice and his playing at a specific time. That is an amazing document to have. Not I'm saying then, you know, in 40 years you're going to look back and go, wow, listen to how I sang then. But it's it's a marking of time, of creative time in some fashion, don't you think? Or am I romanticizing the whole making of CD?
No, I completely agree. Oh, I completely agree. And even I was driving home through the blizzard and listening to your first guest, and then that writing a book. I mean, I'm sure it's all the same. It captures where you are mentally, spiritually, you know, physically at that time.
Yeah, and emotionally. Well, and also, and emotionally too, I think.
And emotionally, yeah. And with this CD, what was especially interesting was that Dennis had the brilliant idea to do it live, which is a risk, but also I think that really captures what you're really doing in a way that a studio doesn't.
And you did it at Piano Forte, which is a place I was talking about with Bob Mamet in the previous segment, which is, I think, a very, very, very special kind of room. I'm going to spend much of this second half hour after the news allowing you to select some songs to be heard. You can. Are you and Dennis performing together anytime soon?
You know, we perform together quite a lot, but nothing is, no big, you know, concert or anything. It's mostly just background here and there at different restaurants and libraries and parties and all of that stuff. But I do, you mentioned my website and everything I have is on there.
So yeah, it is.
I wish I had some highlighted performance to give you right now.
No, don't be silly. You can go. You were this Sunday at Mancini's Pizza Pasta Cafe in Oak Park. You're going to be there next Sunday.
We're there most Sundays.
And with the Drunken Bean, you're going to be at the Drunken Bean on December 7th with Andy. Andy plays guitar and also sings, and Andy is, you're an attractive couple. I remember when you said, when you guys both said that you fell in love with each other, it really was love at first sight in high school. It's one of the most charming stories I've I've heard, because I've always maintained that no writer should be together and no jazz musician should be together. But I've been proven wrong by Judy and Greg, and there are a million people I've been proven wrong by, and you and Andy are among those. We're going to take a little commercial break. We'll come back, and Petra Van Noyes will indulge me for another half hour. You'll hear some music from her latest CD with Dennis Lukshin, who I have to meet one of these days. It is titled Because We're Night People. Go to PetraSings.com for a bunch of information, and stay tuned.
Midnight. You have It's midnight. Come on and train.
That is just a small sample of the musical genius that is Petra Van Noyes and Dennis Lukshin on their new CD, their first CD together, Because We're Night People. I forgot to tell you before I start talking to Petra again that, hey, Bears fans, enter your chance to win two spots on the all-inclusive Bears fan trip to Cancun at chicagotribune.com/monster giveaway, courtesy of the Chicago Tribune. Doesn't Cancun, I don't like Cancun, but I do like Mexico. Doesn't Mexico sound like a nice place to be right now, Petra Van Noyes?
Yes, it does.
Let me ask you the meaning of I'm sort of captivated by the title of your CD, Because We're Night People, because there night means different things to different people. There are some people for whom night is the kind of quarter to three. There's no one in the place except you and me. Where for others, it's an exuberant kind of time. I think this CD captures both of those. Do you? And did you? I mean, obviously you gave some thought to, hey, Dennis, what are we going to call our CD? but could I explore the philosophy behind it? Very intrigued by it.
It's all night songs, and it's, you know, I agree. Some people think of night and starting at, you know, 5 p.m., 9 p.m. is their night. We're talking about late night, because we're late night people as musicians.
Right.
And you're an after hours guy. This should be the theme CD for your show.
It should. No, you're absolutely right. No, we can pay no money, but yeah, man, who knows what that'll get you.
Okay.
When you decided, when you go about, you know, you don't just, I can't imagine you say, hey, I've got the perfect 13 songs for this. How do you compile this? I mean, you talk about songs with one another and things that you, obviously you have to like these songs, but are they things that play to certain strengths of both of you as musicians?
Yes, and I do kind of think thematically. I work at a lot of libraries, believe it or not. I play at about 40 area libraries regularly, and they all enjoy themes. I don't know if it's just the whole literary thing or something. You know, they all want to kind of tie something in with the theme. So I've thought of many themes just from my vast list of tunes, things that work in different themes. And when Dennis mentioned doing a CD, and because of the sensitive qualities that I mentioned in the earlier segment about his playing, and because we both kind of like the moody songs and the dreamy songs and the ballads, and because he plays so pretty, I just kind of thought that the night theme would be perfect, and I've always kind of had in my mind to do that. And then we had this song called Night People. This is a song that was written by the great songwriting team of Fran Landisman and Tommy Wolfe.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people that wrote Spring Can Really Hang You Up the Most and The Ballad of Sad Young Men. And they also wrote this song called Night People, which was used in their Broadway show Night People, which was a short run of a Broadway show in the, I believe, maybe the mid-50s, maybe early 60s. But it's kind of a hipster show in a way, like a Beat Generation type show about kind of just counterculture people, and this song Night People just really jumped out to me, I always loved the song. And in fact, I know you're great friends with Judy Roberts.
Oh, yeah, I love
Judy. Yeah, years ago she had told me, you should sing this song, Night People. And I already loved the song. And then when Dennis said, let's make a CD, and I was thinking about this night theme, I just, of course, that song jumped into my mind. And my- I actually knew a lot of these songs already, but I learned a few specifically for this CD because there were songs I had already wanted to learn anyway,
yeah.
And then this was the perfect excuse.
What is one of those songs? Because after I'm going to let you go soon and just play play a couple tunes, I'm going to certainly play Night People because I want to hear that. And what's another one? What's one that you that was kind of a revelation for you?
The song I like the most on the CD is song number 3, which you'll see in front of you, probably if you have the CD.
It's called The Piano
Player. Yeah, also known as 1001 Saloons.
The life story of Rick Hogan.
Exactly. This is a story song, and I know you like stories.
I do, very much.
This is a song. Yeah, oh, go ahead.
No, I just want to ask how Andy is. Good.
Oh, Andy is good. He's doing very well.
I think it's probably time to catch up with the two of you in print, because as much as I like doing radio, that's what I really do. And I was looking back at this story. I mean, the story is from 2014, and 4 years in the life of a jazz couple is like 20 years in the life of a normal couple, I would have to think.
Oh,
and I just, I'm intrigued by the fact that you're doing a lot of libraries now, too, really. I think...
it's a new hustle, I think.
Yes, so to speak. Petra, it is, I'm going to play music for you. Go to sleep. Go to PetraSings.com to find out where she's playing, and stay tuned because you will hear her sing after a few commercials, and you will get a sense of how really, really beautiful. Please tell Dennis, who I may have encountered in one of my 1001 saloons, but I don't think we formally met, and tell him I'm an incredible admirer. The CD is called Because We're Night People, Petra Van Noy's Night Night.
Night, night. Thank you.
Okay, say hi to Andy. Thanks. Say hi to Andy. Okay, bye.
Happy holidays.
Yes, indeed. So to speak. welcome back. If you're in a car, be very, very careful. If you're at home, pull up the covers. I let Petra Van Noy's go to sleep, but you can listen to her music. She has a number of CDs, some with her husband, Andy Brown. But we were talking specifically tonight about Because We're Night People with Dennis Lukshin on piano. Here's one she was talking about that she seemed very, very fond of. It is called The Piano Player, 1001 Saloons.
There are nights when I have a little glow, the customer's generous and taking it slow. When the music sounds good, even to me, then somewhere in the room a certain face I see. And sing it just for him. But the face is gone by the second set, and the drunks begin to cry. Then I think about looking up what's his name? Either that or die. I've paid my dues, learned to sing the blues in 1001 saloons. The
owners are tough and the customers rough. In a thousand and one saloons, the living is hard and the men are the same. While clouds of smoke filter into your brain, play Frisco and baby till they drive you insane. In a thousand and one saloons. Of smoke filter into your brain. Play Ipanema till it drives you insane. In a thousand.
I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. I think Petra Van Noyes is a great singer. We have a full studio here, ladies and gentlemen. That was taped live at Piano Forte. I'm going to select another one. Okay, it's about 10. We got about 8 minutes left. Let's do Aubrey Mumpower, genius engineer. Cut 10, The Night We Called It a Day.
Night we call it a day. Rise with the dawn. There wasn't a thing left to say. The night we called it a day.
Quite a song. It's quite a voice. The reason you're hearing clapping is because Petra Van Noyes and Dennis Luxon, Petra on vocals, Dennis on keyboard, recorded that at Pianoforte on South Michigan Avenue, which is an amazing place. They do mostly classical stuff there. But as you heard Bob Mamet talking from 9:40 to 10:20 about his career as a jazz performer in Chicago, he has played there too. I want to thank Ron Balson for being on. You can get his books by going to his website, ronaldbalson.com. You can check out Bob Mamet at Bob Mamet. B-O-B-M-A-M-E-T. Yes, he is the stepbrother of David Mamet, the world's famous playwright. And you can go to Petra, P-E-T-R-A, sings.com to get a copy of CD. You just heard some music from. It's really, I think, really, really lovely. Dennis Luxon, a pianist I do not know, but who is revered on the local scene. It is their first collaborative effort, and it is really a stunner. Ben Anderson, thanks for your genius producing. Roger Badish, I hope you can get home tonight. Aubrey Mumpower, you're welcome to stay here as long as you want, as long as there's food in the icebox. And all you people out there, be very, very, very careful.